One of the most exciting pieces of news for me this week was the kind of landmark ruling against a teenage boy in Adelaide who's become the first person to be charged under new laws that criminalise deepfake pornography.
Oh, interesting.
So this is something that, especially in schools, has become incredibly obvious as an emerging problem.
For yeah, wildfire.
New frontier of women being
abused.
Abused and having our bodies mistreated. But, yeah, it's interesting. He was charged with 2 counts of creating or altering sexual material without consent. And he's going to be returning to court in South Australia for a hearing next month. But that is pretty... That's a pretty big precedent to be setting around all of this emerging technology and how vulnerable it makes all women to being sexually exploited, often without their knowledge. There have been a few public cases also just reported on in the media of people finding out that their close friends, quote-unquote friends, have been producing lots and lots of deepfake porn content and circulating it on the internet and things like that. So it's not a small issue, and I think it's pretty heartening that there's been a precedent set that there are going to be consequences.
Well, that's interesting. It certainly is interesting. It's a Pandora's box, literally.
And another update in the world of Australian law. Annie, I'm going to give you the honour of talking about this because you're very excited.
I'm quite excited. Defeat of Min's anti-protest laws, a victory for the Palestine movement and democracy. Or as I like to say, Min's anti-protest laws bites the dust. Stop the War on Palestine spokesperson Adam Alderpour says Min's attack on the democratic rights of the people of New South Wales has failed and he stands condemned. He must resign immediately.
And it was the third time a law put forward by the Min's government affecting protest rights has been struck down by the Supreme Court. So this is becoming an emerging trend of trying to insert themselves in the landscape of civil rights, completely at odds with our basic kind of constitutional entitlement to showing up when we want to about the issues we care about. And I think it's also, I think, worth pointing out that even in the short period of time that these laws were in effect, they were having a real impact on, and they're still having an impact on the way that people are able to show up politically.
It's pretty extraordinary that the Min's police force have been doing dawn raids on people who were...
attended the Herzog rally.
Well, and they were actually... It was a police riot. It wasn't a demonstrator's riot.
No, and it was these laws that have just been underturned that were responsible for the Min's government saying to the police, you have essentially the go-ahead to come and break up this protest, essentially giving them a full
but it didn't stop them. They just continued after the event.
I was watching mainstream media that shall remain unnamed, but they were saying... they were twisting themselves into a pretzel to say protesting, pro-democracy protesters win in the Constitutional Court. I don't know. They were terribly confused on how to report on the story.
Yeah, right.
But we're not.
We're not. No. We're happy.
I'm zooming out a bit. I'll bring some updates from what's happening in West Asia just for everyone that wants to remain updated as the situation just continues to change. Iran's foreign minister Abbas Araghchi declared that the Strait of Hormuz, in line with the ceasefire that was just announced in Lebanon, will be completely open for the remaining period of the ceasefire. In a post on X, Araghchi specified that the strait will be open on the coordinated route, referring to the part that runs near Iran's coast. President Donald Trump responded by thanking Iran for opening the, quote, Strait of Iran. In a post on Truth Social, incredibly large games going on here. Shortly after, Trump added that the naval blockade will remain in full force and effect as it pertains to Iran until ongoing negotiations are complete. This process should go very quickly in that most of the points are already negotiated.
Someone put in a really interesting analysis of the so-called peace treaty. You know that the Americans sent... J.D. Vance, who took his wife to Pakistan to the peace talks while the Iranians went in a plane that had 168 seats reserved with the pictures of all the children that were killed in that first attack. And a considerable group of people in the negotiating team. So J.D. Vance, the Americans, how serious are the Americans in when they
Well,
actually...
I mean, Donald Trump was at the UFC while this was all happening.
Yeah. Bizarre.
I think it also reflects the fragility of these ceasefires. Obviously, for the last year we've
Is it a cease or is it a fire?
That sounded a bit like slam poetry, Annie. But anyway, we've obviously been reporting for the last year on the constant kind of commitments to ceasefires by Israel that are immediately undermined by them continuing to shell people or shell communities. But in particular, this ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon is kind of designed to not be
permanent.
No, I think
that's fire.
Yes. So it's in place for 10 days to provide a bit of background information to the listeners. But interestingly, Mr. Netanyahu has been incredibly explicit about the fact that it's a temporary ceasefire. And their key demand to make it permanent, quote unquote, is to demand that Hezbollah is dismantled. But they also have stated that they have no plans to withdraw forces from southern Lebanon during any ceasefire, which, you know, kind of makes it difficult to comprehend how this could be interpreted as a good faith ceasefire if you're continuing to occupy territory.
That's interesting because yesterday, if you wanted to catch up with a very good interview on Green Left Radio's breakfast show, they did a really interesting interview with a young Iranian, and they actually asked her about the role of Hezbollah, and she said that Hezbollah exists because the government has been unable to protect their people, that's its role, that's what Hezbollah is for.
And it's a pretty common historical story, and obviously present day story. It's really similar to the origins of the IRA. Mm. The provisional IRA's origin was essentially because of communities being brutalized, and there being no state led protection for those communities. So communities take these matters into their own hands, and that looks like what we tend to define as terrorism.
Yeah, well. Yeah, focusing on the existence or non-existence of Hezbollah on the part of the Israeli occupying and aggressive army is really just mealy-mouth words, isn't it, when it comes to diplomacy, in inverted commas.
But it makes the lines between who's allowed to use force and violence,
yes,
who's supposed to put up with it, incredibly clear.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's like shackling people and saying, just sit there so that we can shoot you. Effectively.
And there's this kind of incredible, I mean, even in the reporting from the ABC, you have this incredibly audacious kind of normalization of Israel very directly and overtly committing to occupying other states' territory.
Yeah, it's theft. It's called theft.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the idea that these populations, it's inappropriate for them to use force, but it's completely appropriate for Israel to protect its security interests with force.
Well, it actually if you want to look at the analysis of it, really, it's they're struggling with the goodies and the baddies. They're struggling. You've got some news about Sudan?
I've got some news about Sudan. Sorry, I thought you were talking to Toby.
No.
I do have some news. I should compose myself before we talk about this part of the news because it's incredibly sad and the situation is only getting worse. But Sudan is entering its fourth year of war, and the International Red Cross has just put out a report with a bit of an overview of what damage has been done so far. The number of missing persons cases recorded by the International Red Cross has reached over 11,000, with an increase of more than 40% in the past year alone. More than 11 million people have been displaced, some of these people repeatedly being displaced. by shifting front lines. Of these people, 4 million have fled the country entirely, seeking safety abroad. Between 70% and 80% of healthcare infrastructure in Sudan's conflict areas is non-operational or critically under-resourced. Nearly 70% of the population rely on agriculture and livestock, which have been severely disrupted. This, combined with the loss of assets and repeated displacement, has placed massive pressure on people's ability to cope and rebuild their lives. Daniel O'Malley, who's the head of the ICRC in Sudan, commented that, quote, "The suffering caused by the war has reached new heights of agony for civilians, not least due to its impact on essential infrastructure, markets, hospitals, water treatment facilities, and energy production plants. We see this in Darfur, the Kordofan, the White Nile, Blue Nile, Khartoum, and the Northern State. The whole country has at some point been affected by indiscriminate attacks."
And of course, this is a resources war. And remember that it's a proxy war that the United Arab Emirates are financing, it would appear.
The other bit of conflict in the Middle East that I'd like to touch on was what's been going on in Syria, because it's been reported, the American government hasn't confirmed this, but it's been reported by Middle Eastern Eye that America has finally finished its removal from Syria. And
withdrawn. They like to use that word. All these nice little words. They packed their bags and they left.
Yes, with all of the kind of implications that are expected to come of it. But it's also been interesting following that situation, because Syria is another example of Israel's ambitions to create more territory for itself. And Netanyahu has committed to maintaining troops in Syria. So that's another bit of another hot spot to be paying attention to, Golan Heights. They are refusing to remove troops despite what's been going on.
It'd be interesting to know if they're overextending themselves, if they could potentially be overextending themselves, and if the sheer physical weight of the expenditure of the ordnance by these aggressive states, the US and Israel, will actually reach some sort of point where they can't actually sustain this aggression.
I think I've heard a pretty compelling argument that one of the reasons for the timing of America getting involved in Iran, the whole war itself, is because there's this limited window of time where America is going to have the global influence and military force and economic force required for Israel to make these gains in territory and hold on to them. So I guess I'm not an expert, so I wouldn't want to presume to know what's going to happen in the next 10 years of a very complex conflict.
If there's another 10 years.
But I think that it will depend on how supported they can be by American influence, wealth and force.
Did you guys have anything on the Viva fire?
Yeah,
I'd just be interested to hear about it, because I haven't been really following that story.
I do have something on the Viva file. It was sent out by Friends of the Earth, Stan, Anna and Ari from the Energy Justice Collective. The fire is the latest in a string of failures at the facility. Since Viva took over operations in 2014, workers have been hospitalised after exposure to hydrochloric acid, oil has spilt from poorly maintained pipes, and loud explosions in gas lines have shaken residents in North Geelong. In 2021, a toxic spill from the refinery released a cocktail of chemicals into Corio Bay at many times the legal limit. The April 16th fire is further evidence of Viva's poor environmental and safety track record and should be grounds for a review of their recent approval for expanding their operations by building a floating gas import terminal. The Viva Energy Terminal, which supplies 50% of Victoria's fuel, has now added to Victorians' pain during a cost of living crisis, which has been exacerbated by war in the Middle East. Now is not the time to be approving further unstable fuel supplies and enlarging the fortunes of careless operators. Now is the time to invest in helping Victorians get off gas through fast and fair electrification to provide stability to our energy market. The fossil fuel supply chain is inherently dangerous, unstable and expensive. They have demands. What happens when the next fire burns on the proposed floating terminal, isolated from emergency services? What happens when the next undetected spill poisons Ramsar-listed wetland? What happens to the community when the next chemical catastrophe renders their coastline toxic or the next inferno poisons their air? Viva Energy has demonstrated themselves to be incapable of caring for the environment, their workers and the community. And they call for the end of this notion that they should be running a floating gas hub in Corio Bay. But I heard on the grapevine that the issue with the Viva site with the explosion was actually to do with increasing the amount of flow through to deal with the fuel shortage. And because of the lack of high-level maintenance, it was an inevitability.
The other thing I really wanted to squeeze in before we move on is the Commissioner for Indigenous Children's response to the horrific video that was circling this week of a 13-year-old being brutalised by an off-duty police officer. The Commissioner commented that the footage, which showed a child being restrained on the floor of a train before being thrown onto a seat, causing her to hit her head on a window, was, quote, deeply disturbing and unsettling to watch. The Commissioner, as a result, has called on the Western Australian Police to immediately conduct an investigation into this matter, describing the event as, quote, a representation of the violence that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children and young people face every day.